You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm Mike Haggerty, and for Vicky Gonzalez, a new book is out today asking us to rethink how we view good and healthy bodies. A view of diet culture that has long embraced thinness, literally restricting women with the size of their bodies, controlling what they can and cannot eat. A dynamic that our next guest says is centuries in the making and since the beginning has disproportionately harmed women of color, who are often left out of the conversation and an idyllic version of wellness. The author is Jessica Wilson, a Sacramento-based registered dietitian and nutritionist, and she joins us now to discuss her new book, It's Always Been Ours, Rewriting the Story of Black Women's Bodies. Thanks for taking the time to join us this morning, Jessica.
Great to be here. Thanks so much, Mike.
You're from Sacramento. When did you become interested in becoming a dietitian nutritionist?
Oh, it's a great question. Actually, the story begins very young. As a young kid, I was always at the top of my growth chart, which as a kid seems like winning, mm-hmm. right? You're always at the top. You don't want to be in the middle. You don't want to be in the bottom. So I actually started becoming more policed for my body size at a young age, which I think inherently just led me into the field of food and looking at bodies, but from a more pathologizing aspect than I am now. So it took a lot of learning and then unlearning in clinical practice to understand like how even I was shaped by these narratives and what that looks like for Black and brown women now.
In a New York Times article that you were featured in, while attending the dietetics program at UC Davis, you were the only Black student. What did that experience tell you about how the societal view of health and wellness shapes the field of nutrition?
I refer to it as the quinoa and kale like path and track of dietetics. That was pretty much it. I was the only Black person there. There were a couple of brown folks, and we ended up like forming this little misfits. It felt like there was everybody else, and then there was us who were, you know, sitting around watching what was happening and wondering what was going on, because we were taught about ourselves, like Black people, like brown people, what they eat and how they need to be eating, you know, quinoa and kale. And so it was a very I would say harmful environment that really taught us there was only one right way to be eating food.
Yeah, eating historically healthy, and we'll put those in quotes, can mean saying goodbye to a lot of beloved cultural food that's been deemed unhealthy. Rice in Asian food, tortillas, naan, noodles, dumplings, the list goes on and on. Where did those restrictions come from in the first place?
A lot of it today and in public health is attributed to the Mediterranean diet, which is historically held up as like the gold standard of diets, a diet that was studied decades ago, only compared against, I believe it was Japanese diets, but they were looking for like the healthiest diet with the folks with, you know, the less heart disease and other markers. But there was not a comparison to, you know, African diets at the time. It was just very based on basically foods that white people were eating, which didn't include, traditional foods. So we've just continued to hold on to those foods as the best ones that people should be eating.
How did your education prepare you and not prepare you as a registered dietitian?
I would say it prepared me 0%. The things that were helpful were biochemistry and then human physiology in grad school, where it became more complex and understanding that calories in were not calories out. So that was like my first exposure to that one, because in dietetics training, you're taught that, you know, everything you eat, you know, turns out, you know, and goes into your body the same way, and all calories are the same regardless of what's happening. But when I started seeing people with eating disorders who were not like very thin, the calories in, calories out, like all of a sudden didn't make sense. People weren't eating and they weren't losing weight, and that shouldn't have been possible according to my training.
Is it fair to say that where the training fell short and what you've learned on your own since you began your career is that, in fact, identities in terms of color and sexual preference, in fact, do in fact play a role in perspectives on health and diet?
That's a really good question. And unfortunately, I think all of our values inherently are shaped by the dominant narrative. So in this one, it would be like the quinoa and kale narratives of what's healthy and what's unhealthy. So I feel like it's hard to separate what society tells us is true and what we adopt as far as what we think is or we should be eating from what and how our cultural foods are policed to, you know, really understanding that, you know, what is at our cultural roots is really, you know, can be really beneficial. And as far as, you know, sexual orientation and gender identity, I think the only thing that comes from these communities is a lot of critical thinking and a lot of critical thought, right? So we're already, you know, as a queer person challenging, you know, what our societal norms are. So I feel like it's an easier leap into understanding like how historical narratives are just not the truth.
Sounds like there's a clash between the uniformity of what's being taught and the diversity of the real world.
And I also think the reality of the real world. So yes, what is being taught is very centrist messaging and reinforced because that is the only research that is done into nutrition and bodies, right? We're not, you know, putting Black and brown folks in research. We're not studying the, you know, cultural benefits to eating cultural foods. So like what is taught is indeed a one size fits all approach that doesn't fit all.
Pushing for equity and treating eating disorders. When did you become aware that there is stigma, stereotype, bias in treating disorders like anorexia, binge eating, and bulimia, which are also tied to mental health?
I think it was that moment where, you know, the same moment I was recognizing that calories in is not calories out, because it was mostly my clients of color who were just naturally larger folks at the time who weren't like the very thin ideal. Medical providers did not know what to do. And even once we were able to get them, you know, to residential or otherwise treatment facilities, they were experiencing a bunch of racial harm while there. So it was that, like both in our practice, in all of the assessment tools, and then having to be in an environment with mostly white folks, like there was, it was harmful the whole way through.
Now, what are some of the most harmful misconceptions that you've run across? how long do we have?
Yeah. But we could start, you know, just cut me off. Of course, the misconception is only thin white girls and women have eating disorders, which is absolutely not true. And another one that I find is the perception that eating disorders are about becoming thin, you know, attaining a thin ideal. And that is a lot of what, you know, body positivity cultures and communities will tell us, you know, it's just, you know, don't want to be thin anymore and it'll be better, but we don't take into account the safety and survival sometimes found for larger folks, folks of color, when we shrink ourselves, both literally and figuratively, via having eating disorders. So like, it's not going to be simple. Another one that I can just throw in there that we can be done is the idea that Black women, brown folks are only getting like the eating disorders that have like an overconsumption. So like binge eating disorder or bulimia. And that really plays into like the largesse assumed in like Black and brown folks. And inherently, you know, restriction is reserved for those who are thin and predominantly white folks. So it, restrictive eating disorders get missed all the time in folks of color.
Is this changing? Is it becoming more inclusive?
I will shout out my friend Whitney Trotter and Angela Goins, who started the first BIPOC eating disorder conference. That'll be held again this summer. A lot of folks attended, which is amazing. So I like to have hope that it is changing. I also see hope in the 20-year-olds who like are listening to this, who are paying attention on social media to these conversations, and also seeing themselves in these conversations in a way. So I really feel like they're our future. And that's what gives me hope, especially if they're becoming clinicians and going into this field.
An awful lot of the challenge that I think all of us have gone through in the last 3 years has to do with food, nutrition.
Right.
How did your role as a dietitian change during the pandemic?
That's a great question. A lot of it became reassurance, right? So I don't know when we all decided that our bodies were going to be the same size from like age 25 to age 85. And that changed for a lot of people during the pandemic. And it wasn't considered like a natural, normal thing. It just like became this disaster of people perhaps gaining a bit of weight because we were less active or doing other things. And so a lot of my job was about like really reassuring people that bodies are not going to be the same. You know, we can still do things and take care of ourselves. And our body doesn't have to look the same, which was a different conversation than what I had been having.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jessica Wilson, a Sacramento-based registered dietitian nutritionist, discussing her new book, It's Always Been Ours, Rewriting the Story of Black Women's Bodies. When did these experiences culminate into a book?
In 2020, my colleague Alicia McCullough and I did the Amplify Melanated Voices Challenge on social media for Instagram followers to like center Black and Brown folks in like discussions of social justice rather than, you know, listening to mostly white folks talk about like what they think about racism. And from that came the New York Times article that you already referenced. And then an editor reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to write a book. I said, no. She asked again. I said, no. That sounds like a lot of work. And then finally she wore me down. So I had to come up with an idea. I had an idea, but I had to come up with a audience. And the dedication starts with For Lexi, who is mentioned in actually all throughout the book, but mostly in the restriction chapter, and decide that it was those folks that I was mostly going to try to reach, the 20s and 30s folks, year olds.
And how did you come to the title? It's Always Been Ours.
And that was an evolving one. It was one of the originals out there, and I kept trying to come up with something that, you know, would really like say everything that was in the book, you know, but then really it was these body narratives have always been ours. We just lost, you know, them along the way when we were told what our bodies, what our food should look like. And I've gotten some really great feedback from friends, like so much of what we've been talking about here and otherwise, it's always been ours. Like we've known this as, you know, cultures that we just have to go in and reclaim that.
What would you say was most challenging about writing the book?
Making, you know, Instagram captions that were 100 words into 65,000 of them was very hard, but also distilling everything into a book. So I cut out like two different chapters entirely. So it was so much. It's been 15 years of clinical experience. So really getting it down into something that was both, you know, helpful and, yeah, distill it all. It's hard.
And what would you say has been most rewarding so far?
I will shout out again those 20-year-olds. I have said to folks all along, they are reading this book and coming back with questions that are so deep that I can't answer them about my book. And I'm like, excuse me, you are not supposed to be smarter than me after reading my book. And they have been. So really, and it's, you know, I wanted it to be for, and it is for all Black women, but the ways that the 20-year-olds are reading my book has been one of the most rewarding experiences to see where our future is headed.
We mentioned a moment ago, Lexi, and you wrote about mentoring Alexia Brown while working at UC Davis. She is a top-ranked gymnast who graduated in 2018, publicly came forward about her experiences with racism and microaggressions while on the team after the murder of George Floyd. What can you share with us about her experiences and what that says about the culture surrounding athletics and fitness?
It's a really good question. So to, again, distill it down, it was like happenstance that I ended up connecting with her. My spouse had been her athletic trainer for the gymnastics team and saw what was happening and saw the tears and bullying that Lexi was experiencing and was like, hey, I don't know anything as a white person. Jessica, can you just come in here and, you know, see what you can do to support her? And I found, again, that me just being there really meant a lot, and being somebody who understood and listened. And then again, so gymnastics particularly is really this microcosm of what's happening in athletics, where we see the bodies of Black women especially, you know, painted as muscular, as aggressive, as, you know, not needing like care and resilient, that are not in a way that our white counterparts are not seen. And so really, you know, Lexi making her body smaller and trying to fit into like whiter gymnastic norms via her eating disorder really, you know, talk about, I think of Serena Williams, I think of many WNBA players and how they're compared and contrasted to their white counterparts.
Since your time at UC Davis, when you were the only Black student studying dietetics, do you think there are strides in having dietitians and nutritionists more reflective of the diverse community that needs the service?
I think there's always the attempt, and I do some guest lectures at UC Davis now, and there's far more folks of color who still, though, will come up to me afterwards and say, I'm really glad to see you survived this, because I don't know how I'm going to make it in these still, you know, classes that promote, like, no white rice, no tortillas, no naan. So they're definitely in there, and, you know, I encourage folks who are in these fields to stick in there, and hopefully one day, you know, the field will adapt to, you know, be more culturally congruent and supportive for folks.
What makes you optimistic that, in fact, we're moving toward that?
In addition to seeing the folks who are in the field, I see a lot of, I get so very on social media, and I do see a lot of clinicians and therapists who are in, you know, food and nutrition coming in and just like not having known the stuff that I am sharing, you know, we'll use intermittent fasting as a very specific example, you know, new diet, good for metabolism, all these things. And I'm like, people who don't have food are fasting. Like, if we're saying that, you know, we're so healthy because we're, you know, not eating, people have not been eating for a very long time who don't have money for food. And so those moments, I think the more poignant ones, people are like, oh, maybe this stuff that I have been learning isn't, you know, really what is helpful for people.
What can we do on an individual level?
Yeah, that one's really hard. So there's two things that I always try and remind folks is that I can feel only, you know, so good about my body. It doesn't really matter how I feel about my body when I go out into, you know, society, depending on how folks treat Black women. But what I can do is really find community so that I'm not alone in that. It can be really hard and really scary, but both seeing myself reflected, having these more in-depth conversations about bodies and body narratives for folks of color, for queer and trans folks, for fat folks, you know, those really have, I've found to be like something that one can rely on internally to know that they're not alone when in this space. Even if I have to perform in a certain way as a Black woman or engage in respectability, I know that that's what it is. It's not me. That's not good enough for a situation.
What do you hope that readers take away from the book? And does that hope differ depending upon who's reading?
Yeah. So I really hope that Black folks feel seen in this book. There's so few books that I have found for me that speak directly about bodies and directly to Black folks. So I really hope people feel seen in this book in ways that haven't done before. And then I really hope that there, for all readers, that there is understanding of the way that respectability politics, the way that resilience and restriction are killing us in some form or another, in a way that allows Black women to just be, to have ease. And then I hope we all celebrate Black joy for the rebellion and resistance it is.
Jessica Wilson is a Sacramento-based registered dietitian nutritionist discussing her new book, It's Always Been Ours, Rewriting the Story of Black Women's Bodies. Jessica, thank you so much for spending the time with us this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. It was great.
Still ahead, the Tahoe Institute for Natural Science joins us to share their efforts in conservation and educating the public on the Tahoe Basin's unique natural history. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm Mike Haggerty, and for Vicki Gonzalez, we're back in just a moment.